just because you have an R behind your name doesn't mean that you don't care about the mountain.
From Wyoming Public Media, this is The Modern West. I'm Micah Schweitzer. In the West, different groups have different ideas on how land should be used. So this time we'll hear about outdoor recreation companies getting into politics and efforts to protect and deregulate public lands. We'll start in Montana. On the state's Great Plains, conservationists and tribes want to rewind the clock and return wild bison to the short grass prairie. But cowboys and ranchers say if that happens, their way of life, their very culture, will disappear. The Mountain West News Bureau's Nate Hedgie reports.
I meet Mark Azure at his kitchen table on the Fort Belknap Indian Reservation in Montana. He's an Iraq War veteran with glasses and a pockmarked face, and he says round here in Indian country,
well, I don't think anybody's had it tougher than we have.
Outside his window, the reservation sprawls across a cold, snow-covered prairie. It's home to a substandard health care center, a few stray dogs, and a highway. Descendants of white settlers drive past in pickup trucks on their way to towns like Haver or Great Falls.
I don't think they really stop and visit and want to understand. You know, it's kind of like two different cultures trying to coexist, and it hasn't always turned out well.
Azure says before those white settlers arrived, all that land was Nakota, Grovant, and Blackfeet territory. Unplowed. A sea of blue gramma grasses and June grasses dotted with massive herds of wild bison.
Buffalo will go way out and use all of the land and then come back to wherever the water is.
The tribes hunted those bison, using the hide for coats, the stomach as a big pot, and the meat to fuel their people. But then the U.S. Army and European settlers swept across the northern Great Plains in the 19th century. They spilled indigenous and bison blood to take those lands, nearly eradicating the animal in a concerted effort to destroy the food source for tribes.
Thank God they didn't. I think they tried both buffalo and Indians, and neither one was successful. So we're both still here.
But a new version of the land was born from those white settlers. One that saw the northern Great Plains as an engine for America, molding the earth and fueling this country with oil, coal, and cattle.
We got to provide food for the world.
That's rancher Alex Bellmeyer. I meet him during a public meeting at an old junior high school gym in Malta, Montana. He's wearing a white cowboy hat with a wind-burnt face, and his family's ran cattle on the short grass prairie near Malta for more than a century.
And it's a tough life, right, being a rancher? Well, it's a lot of work. It keeps us busy, but it's a good lifestyle.
And ranching is what makes Malta tick. Bellmeyer says without it, this town would just be a brown smudge along the Amtrak line between Chicago and Seattle. Ranchers buy 50-cent coffee at the roadside diner, they get their gas at the local Conoco, and most of their kids go to the Malta school district.
Ranchers and farmers keep the place going.
But over the past few decades, America has drifted away from its agricultural roots, and now there are new folks coming to the Great Plains with a new vision of the land. They're called the American Prairie Reserve. For the past two decades, they've bought up ranches around Malta, kicked out the cattle, and replaced them with wild bison. Their goal is to turn back time and create one of the largest private nature preserves in the country. Damian Austin helps run ground operations.
We're just looking for a small piece of land, in reality, to try to preserve an ecosystem.
And that ecosystem includes a massive herd of wild bison and eventually wolves and grizzly bears. There's also luxury camping, bison hunting, and hiking trails for the urban tourist. The reserve controls around 500,000 acres now, but it wants to buy more ranch land. And this horrifies cattlemen like Alex Bellmeyer and Ed Butcher.
If you have nothing but wild bison and antelope, then you might as well take the town out.
They're destroying not just a way of life, they're destroying a very vital economic base, which is a foundation of an entire America.
The Fort Belknap Indian Reservation sees things differently and is embracing the new vision. They've been working to return bison to the landscape themselves for a few decades now. And Mark Azure of the Nakota tribe doesn't have a lot of sympathy for ranchers.
Welcome to the club.
He says they don't have to sell their land if they don't want to.
You know, we weren't given an option. You know, it was kill the Indian, save the man. You know, and how did they do that? Through wiping out as many of those buffalo as they could.
And now those buffalo are returning to the short grass prairie, surrounded by fences, ranches, and a new old vision of the land. One that comes after the plow, the cattle, and the coal. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Nate Hedgie in Malta, Montana.
When you hear about companies like REI or Patagonia, you might think about tents, boots, or puffy jackets. But how about politics? These outdoor companies are part of a new wave of business advocates fighting for public lands. The Mountain West News Bureau's Amanda Peacher has the story.
Last spring, the outdoor retail industry had what you might call a moment of truth.
The proposal coming out of the administration was quite profound.
That's Mark Bereka with REI. The Trump administration had its eye on national monuments, and it looked as though the Interior Department could remove protections for several of them. For the first time, REI made a national push to members and customers, asking them to submit comments against the plan.
I'd say we just turned up the dial a bit.
Outdoor clothing companies like North Face and Keen also took a stand. John Sterling isn't surprised by this.
Biker up. Oh.
Dozens of mountain bikers zoom by as we take a hike along a popular trail in Bend, Oregon. Sterling leads the Conservation Alliance, a nonprofit group that works with businesses to protect wild places and habitat. Sterling says places like this are a testament to the economic importance of public lands.
Bend is a community that is growing and economically doing pretty well, and a lot of that is dependent on public lands.
Outdoor businesses are also dependent on these lands.
It's part of the identity of the industry and of individual companies. And if you want to try taking that away, they're going to respond.
Sterling says in the past, companies showed their love for nature by supporting non-controversial efforts like trail maintenance or environmental education. But taking on the Interior Department is a whole new level of advocacy. And Patagonia did more than taking a stand. When the proposal to shrink two national monuments actually went ahead, the company sued the Trump administration. Sterling says that's different than an environmental group filing a lawsuit.
Anytime a company sticks their neck out on an issue that could stir up some controversy, they have to think about how that affects their brand.
And Patagonia, at least, doesn't seem concerned. In addition to filing a lawsuit, it's reaching out beyond its typical customer base.
If you want to get something done, you need a large coalition of people.
That's Patagonia's Coralie Kenna.
This issue transcends politics.
She says the company is now working with a number of sportsmen's groups.
We were thinking, who else would be as dedicated to this cause?
With that in mind, Patagonia founder Yvonne Chouinard was a guest speaker recently at the annual meeting of the Backcountry Hunters and Anglers.
Well, I tell you, it's a real honor to be invited to be up here. This is the most amazing group I've ever seen.
Political advocacy was on the agenda earlier in the day. Tonight's theme was campfire storytelling.
So I've got a couple of short stories because at my age, I can't keep a long story going. I forget why I'm up here. So.
Chouinard's progressive and unrelenting views on conservation are well known. And in this conservative-leaning crowd, Chouinard got a standing ovation.
Thank you.
None of this surprises Ryan Callahan.
Just because you have an R behind your name doesn't mean that you don't care about the mountain.
Callahan is with First Light, an Idaho company that sells high-end hunting clothes. First Light worked with Patagonia on the monuments campaign.
We get a tremendous amount of support when we put out calls to action on these issues.
And he says the calls to action are good for the company's bottom line.
Everybody's saying, like, this is exactly why I buy from First Light.
And this approach may be good for a politician's bottom line, too. Pro-public land candidates seem to be doing well in the Rocky Mountains. Take the 2016 win of Montana Governor Steve Bullock. Or take Raul Labrador. The congressman got a 0% score from the League of Conservation Voters. And Labrador was just defeated in Idaho's gubernatorial primary. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Amanda Peacher.
It'll soon be impossible to get oil and gas leases on 24,000 acres of the Wyoming Range. A conservation nonprofit called the Trust for Public Land bought out existing leases within the Wyoming Range to maintain the area for wildlife and recreation. It's the second time the group has done this in the western part of Wyoming, bringing the total number of retired acres by the trust to 80,000. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim spoke with Chris Deming, a project manager with the Trust for Public Land.
Working with Stanley and Mountain Energy, we successfully came up with a business solution to a conservation problem. In that, we avoided more oil and gas development in the Wyoming Range, which is an area that has been of concern over the proposed drilling as far back as the mid-1990s.
So what's problematic about this area as far as energy development, and why does wildlife and other factors supersede that?
Starting in the mid-90s, the residents of northwest Wyoming were concerned about the impacts to wildlife, their recreational pursuits, be it hunting, fishing, or horseback riding, the impacts of the proposed oil and gas drilling to water, and the impacts to air quality. You may have heard of the Red Desert to Hoback Corridor. The collaring work and the data that has been discovered through that effort shows that much of the Wyoming Range is the summer habitat for many of those mule deer and large ungulate that travel south to north through that corridor. Those residents really galvanized around this area and helped voice their concerns over the proposed drilling, which has affected the positive conservation outcome over the last 15 years.
So was there proposed drilling there? Were there leases that were owned? Was there any active oil rigs or anything else? Or was that all held off?
There's a combination of all of the above. When the Wyoming Range effort started, one of the things that was critical to any protection work being done was the Wyoming Range Legacy Act. Starting in 2007, the late Senator Craig Thomas introduced legislation that was carried forth and approved with the support of Senator Barrasso and Mike Enzi, which designated an area of about 1.2 million acres in the Wyoming Range for future protection. Within that 1.2 million acres, no future oil and gas lease permits would be let, and any existing valid leases were eligible to be acquired by organizations like the Trust for Public Land, handed back to BLM to be relinquished and retired in perpetuity.
Is this the second part of the retirement? Has there already been some part of the Wyoming Range that was retired, or is this the first time something like this happened in the Wyoming Range?
This is the second time. The Trust for Public Land got engaged in 2010 in an effort to acquire nearly 56,000 acres of oil and gas leases from PXP, a Houston-based oil and gas company. We moved forward with that and through a successful fundraising effort, Save the Hoback campaign, we were able to acquire PXP's leases in the Wyoming Range at the end of 2012.
So I've heard you say this is a business solution to a conservation problem a few times. Can you elaborate on what that means?
Yeah, we are not an advocacy organization. We've been very successful in working with oil and gas companies such as PXP and now Stanley Energy and Mountain Energy to, in essence, acquire their oil and gas leases using private dollars to compensate them for their investment in that area. In lieu of drilling, we were acquiring those leases from them and handing them back to BLM to be retired in perpetuity.
So I think that the perpetuity part sounds pretty clear, but is there any way that this land in the future could be used for oil and gas, or it's now illegal?
There was a congressional legislation that was approved in 2009. It is part of legislation, and only way that that could be undone is if future legislation unwound what was done and put in place.
So how was this possible? Where did the money come from to be able to do this?
The recent acquisition of the Stanley and Mountain Energy leases was thanks to a generous grant from the Weiss Foundation, enabling us to move forward with the acquisition and retirement of those leases.
So what are the next steps for actually getting this land retired?
Yeah, after our acquisition on July 3rd, we've been working with BLM Wyoming to relinquish and retire the leases that we just acquired from Stanley and Mountain Energy. We anticipate that the completion of the retirement of these leases will happen within the next 30 days.
Great. Well, thanks for making time for me today, Chris.
I appreciate it.
That's Chris Deming with the Trust for Public Land talking with Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim. In addition to the 24,000 acres of newly retired leases, there's another swath of 21,000 acres of oil and gas leases also slated for retirement. The two deals increase the total non-drillable acreage in the Wyoming Range to over 100,000 acres. Even as some lands are being protected from development, others are being made available for broader use. Dotted across the Mountain West are huge swaths of federal land called wilderness study areas. They aren't protected wilderness, but they're under review to see if they can be upgraded to that. But here's the wrinkle. Many of these reviews happened decades ago, or Congress never took action. That means many of the lands are treated a lot like wilderness. They're protected. Now, a senator from Montana is taking action to open these areas to more forms of recreation. Some folks are happy with this idea, others not so much. Nate Hedgie traveled to southwestern Montana and spoke to people on all sides.
Life's been tough on Chris Marchand. There was a high school football injury, the knee replacement.
Unfortunately, I got a hip that's wore out.
We're standing alongside a gravel road near a cow pasture. And nowadays, this is about as close as Marchand can get to the Sapphire Wilderness Study Area. You can see it out there in the distance, a clump of rolling gray mountains.
So this is Emmerine Mountain. It's in the clouds. That's where the...
Marchand grew up in a nearby mining town, and he says back then the Sapphires were an escape.
If you think about being confined in a mine or in a smelter, your day off to be out somewhere where there's blue sky and trees and, you know, clean water.
It meant a lot, but nowadays Marchand believes the Sapphire Wilderness Study Area is in trouble. There's legislation moving through Congress that would strip away protections for it and some other wilderness study areas in Montana. If passed, it would open these lands to more motorized vehicles and even potential mining. Steve Daines introduced the legislation and says it's long overdue. Daines is a Republican and one of Montana's U.S. senators.
This should have been done shortly after 1982. And what we're doing here, I think, is pretty common sense. We're just looking at those areas that have been deemed not suitable for wilderness to release those.
At an ATV store in Phillipsburg, Montana, I meet up with Stan Spencer. He's a snowmobiler.
You know, I've been riding in the backcountry since, you know, the early 80s. I hate to admit it, but I am 74 years old, and I still enjoy getting back out there. That's my thing.
But he says he can't snowmobile in many wilderness study areas if they're managed like de facto wilderness. So he's really happy about Daines' legislation.
I feel he took the bull by the horns and said, we need to make a decision.
Still, conservationists are frustrated Senator Daines never held public meetings before introducing his legislation. Plus, it eliminates study areas without creating new wilderness. Paul Spittler is with the Wilderness Society, a conservation group. He says one-sided legislation like this has never passed Congress.
They generally receive a lot of public opposition.
And there's some history to back that up. A similar Wyoming bill never made it to the president's desk, while Idaho took a more balanced approach that did.
It was a collaborative effort between ranchers, conservation interests, county commissioners, and others. And so they sat down and ultimately reached agreement. Some of these areas would be designated as wilderness. Some of the areas would be removed from wilderness study area status, and everyone came out ahead.
But the current legislation won't create any new wilderness. Daines counters that's because it's about restoring balance. He says Congress has only eliminated 150,000 acres worth of wilderness study areas in Montana. At the same time, he says, it's created more than 1 million acres of new wilderness there.
It seems like it's kind of a one-sided. It's like we only are adding wilderness right now in our state. That's what I've supported that. I'm just saying, if you listen to tens of thousands of Montanans who are very concerned about the fact that the state is getting out of balance.
Back at the edge of the Sapphire Wilderness Study Area, Chris Marchand is watching a herd of elk move across a valley.
I got my binoculars here, but see, there's a whole bunch of elk.
He's 65 years old, and he hopes these lands will remain protected.
I can't do as many things as I used to. Some of these areas I'll never go back and see as much as I did when I was younger. But the fact to be out there and know that they still exist and that other people can go have the experiences I had, that's really important.
There are hundreds of these wilderness study areas scattered across the Mountain West. Daines' legislation on cutting them back in Montana is moving through the Senate. The state's lone congressman, Republican Greg Gianforte, just introduced companion legislation in the House. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Nate Hedgie in Phillipsburg, Montana.
And that's our episode for this month. We'll have a new one next month. And in the meantime, you can find lots more stories and episodes at our website, themodernwest.org. David Graff produced this episode. Anna Rader is our web editor. The theme music is by Jeff Troxell. And I'm Micah Schweitzer. The Modern West is a production of Wyoming Public Media.